Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned about an unconventional and adorable solution for reigniting that marital spark.
This sounds horrible, but do you ever wonder what it would be like if you and your wife were separated by something bigger? Like death, like her death.
I have given it a fair amount of thought.
Not in any painful way, but just like a gentle floating off.
It's gotta be peaceful. I mean, this is the mother of your children.
And then the new wife would be great.
25 years of marriage and you have nothing to say?
I guess what I'm trying to say is that now that I'm married, I'm definitely feeling a little freaked out about the fact that I'm gonna have sex with only one person for the rest of my life.
Ah, the dim plateau of marriage. Such an inevitability that it's become a classic movie trope. In real life, when couples attempt to deal with their own marital dissatisfaction, the focus is often on changing how each person acts to one another, being more attentive or complimentary or helpful or whatever the issue is. But research has shown that marital satisfactions can still decline despite day-to-day behaviors. So researchers thought they'd take another approach. Instead of targeting behavior, why not focus on how a person thinks about his or her spouse? Action, of course, plays a role in how you feel about your spouse, but so does positive and negative associations. Those associations can come directly from the person you're married to, but they can also come from completely unrelated things, like if you've had a bad day or a terrible commute, you can feel more negative toward your spouse. So researchers wanted to test whether linking a positive stimulus to an unrelated one could create positive associations over time. There are already examples of this kind of conditioned response, the most famous being Pavlov's dogs. That's the study where dogs salivated at the sound of the bell after being exposed to multiple pairings of meat and the sound. So researchers did something similar with humans. 144 married couples who had been married for about 5 years volunteered for the study. First, researchers wanted to measure how each spouse felt about the other. So they had the couples rate overall relationship satisfaction at the outset. But they also tested something called implicit attitudes. This is a more direct, immediate, of-the-moment feeling of the person you're married to. So with these bases set, the couples were sent home. Each spouse was charged with viewing a stream of images regularly for 6 weeks. It didn't take long, but they had to do it about once every 3 days. There were two groups. The experimental group always viewed positive images, like pictures of puppies, bunnies, and positive words like wonderful. And embedded in the stream were photos of each person's spouse. The control group had a neutral stream of images, like buttons or things like that. And same thing here, photos of their spouses were peppered throughout. During the 6 week period, the couples also regularly rated their implicit attitudes toward their spouses. And researchers found the positive imagery worked. Participants who were exposed to the puppies and bunnies showed more positive implicit reactions to their partner over the course of the 6 week experiment compared to those in the neutral group. What's more is that those positive automatic reactions correlated with greater improvements in marital satisfaction over the course of the study. The lead researcher actually admitted he was quite surprised that this worked out. Of course, previous conditioning studies suggested that it would, but emotions wound up in human relationships are a curious and often stubborn thing. He was amazed that something so simple and unrelated to marriage could change it. And while it is absolutely delightful that photos of puppies can bring a couple closer together, the researchers do note that ultimately how a couple interacts with one another is the most important thing. So no, you're not allowed to just spend the rest of your marriage looking at bunnies. This week I learned why planes can't take off in extreme heat. It's summertime, and in Phoenix, that means it's H-O-T. But this week, temperatures crept up to the danger zone, peaking around 120 degrees. Now, I knew that extreme heat can do a number on the human body. It can make you feel physically ill and exhausted, it can cause heat stroke and even death. But I did not know that heat can also ground planes.
extreme heat forcing even more flight cancellations in and out of Phoenix between today.
Thanks to the good people at Wired, I now know why. It's not actually the heat that is preventing liftoff. It's all the environmental conditions that come with it. You see, the warmer the air, the less dense it is. The less dense the air, the less air molecules there are bumping around. And air molecules are what help that plane get off the ground. As the plane speeds down the runway, air molecules collide with the wing. And in collisions, even the smallest ones, there is a change of momentum. And with a change of momentum comes force. Now, force, as you have probably experienced, is not one-sided. It's an interaction between two objects. So if you bump into someone, you both go spilling outwards. So in the collision between the air and the wing, the force that sends the air molecule bursting off in one direction also pushes against the wing. And in that moment, two things happen. That collision creates an upward force on the airplane wing that some people call lift, and also creates a backward force called drag. Meanwhile, the engine of the plane creates thrust, which balances the lift and drag and keeps the plane moving right along. The bigger the aircraft, the greater surface area of the wing, the more air molecules can hit the plane. So, in the blazing heat of an Arizonan afternoon, when the air is thin and there are fewer air molecules floating around, there's much less force to help lift and drag the airplane into movement. This is particularly a problem for smaller aircrafts because they have less engine thrust and smaller wingspan. And it was the smaller airplanes that were overwhelmingly grounded in Phoenix. One way to compensate for the decreased air density is to increase speed. But to increase the speed of the airplane, you'd need a longer runway than the one Phoenix could provide. This week I learned that clownfish make extremely dutiful dads.
Dad, can I go play too? Can I?
I would feel better if you go play over on the sponge beds. That's where I would play.
So the overly concerned dad from Finding Nemo was actually fairly accurate. Clownfish, also known as anemone fish, because they make their homes in sea anemones, will do almost anything to support their offspring. In fact, their parenting instincts are so strong that if you gave a bachelor clownfish someone else's eggs, he would care for them, removing debris or fanning them with the oxygen-rich water. Any other fish would have just eaten them. A new study finally figured out what makes these helicopter dads tick. Anemone fish are directed by a few very potent hormonal signals. One is almost identical to oxytocin, which in humans is known as the love hormone and is associated with nurturing. So in the study, when researchers blocked this hormone in the anemone fish, the dads stopped tending to their young. Later, when researchers suppressed another hormone that regulates dominance, aggression, and courtship, they found a surprising result. The anemone dads actually became even more attentive to their offspring. It was surprising because the fish are already paragons of parenting, so it was hard to imagine that there could be an increase in their parental efforts. But researchers think that when that defense hormone is blocked, the fish can shift the effort it would have allotted to protecting the nest to caring for its young. This week I learned that the African wildebeest migration, really the most spectacular migration on Earth, is a dark yet fascinating example of the circle of life. Once a year, some 1.2 million wildebeest, accompanied by large numbers of zebras, gazelles, and antelopes, trample through the Serengeti in search of food and water. This is the largest overland migration in the world, and during which the animals will travel nearly 500 miles. And while the migration may seem like a frenzy of chaotic movement, research has shown that wildebeest actually use something that's referred to as swarm intelligence, where they methodically explore and overcome an obstacle as one. But it is a dangerous passage. Predators like lions, leopards, hyenas, and cheetahs line the route, taking advantage of easy prey, the young, the sick, the exhausted. And there's another danger, the perilous Mara River, the iconic Kenyan River. This is by far the most dramatic part. The wildebeest have to swim across through rapids and eager crocodiles that will snap them in half for dinner. On average, more than 6,000 wildebeest will die here, either by drowning or crocodiles. But here's what's really cool about nature. As tragic as this is, those mass deaths help the surrounding ecosystem more than they hurt the herd. For the first time, researchers were able to calculate the fate of an animal carcass as it drowns, decomposes, and enters the river ecosystem. And the journey is pretty incredible. This group of ecologists found that 6,000 dead wildebeest amount to more than 1,000 tons of biomass, which is a lot. And all that biomass is a boon to the local river ecosystem, feeding almost everyone and everything there. The biggest winners are the various species of fish in the river. During migration, the carcasses make up half of the diet for these fish. Many of the most important contributions aren't necessarily noticeable to the naked eye. Those carcasses deliver essential elements like phosphorus and carbon that are fundamental to living organisms right into the river's food web. And even when the carcass has been picked to the bones, those skeletons continue to leach even more nutrients into the waters, feeding the ecosystem for years to come. In the end, the yearly mass drownings account for only 0.5% of the total size of the herd. And if those drownings didn't happen, that loss could be responsible for fundamentally altering river ecosystems. Death is essential. Which is why, evolutionarily speaking, the wildebeest continue the dangerous passage each year. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, check out theweek.com/podcast, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers podcast. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, we'd like to offer you 4 risk-free issues of The Week magazine. To get those, visit theweek.com/4free. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.